Well, it was back in 1992. I remember this. I thought it was a stemwinder, if you ask me. Pat Buchanan was addressing the Republican National Convention. You remember this? And he used a term that too many sounded novel, too many sounded over the top and radical. He used the term culture war. He was much excoriated for making that statement. However, the term stuck. And the only question that remains, really, is did he make this up? How long has the culture war been underway as a culture war? And what role does a democratic movement, a specifically Christian democratic movement, have in the ongoing culture war? Alan Carlson is our guest for the next half hour of Issues Etc. He's a regular guest. He's president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois. He's author of several books, including his latest called Fractured Generations, Crafting a Family Policy for the 21st Century America. And also, he's written an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled The Long Culture War. Alan, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Pleased to be with you.
Did Pat Buchanan, did he kick off the culture wars? Did they begin in 1992 at that stemwinder speech he gave at the Republican National Convention?
Well, a new American version of it perhaps began, but the term actually goes back well into the 19th century, back 140 years ago, essentially, to the an attempt by Bismarck, who had just unified the German Empire, to kind of press down on all religion in general and to suppress Catholicism in particular. And he launched a Kulturkampf, a culture war against the first target was, again, the Roman Catholic Church in the new empire, but more broadly, seeking to quiet the political activity of all churches.
Well, that's when the term then comes up. When, if we trace kind of modern political history, perhaps beginning right around the time of the American Revolution or thereabouts, when did Christians as a segment of society begin to understand themselves as engaged in a culture war, even if they were not using either Bismarck's or Buchanan's term?
The really original thrust was really the French Revolution of 1789. Americans often confuse it with the American Revolution and think it was the same thing, but it was something much more radical. The French revolutionaries clearly targeted Christianity as something that had to go. Even such things as starting the calendar with the birth of Christ as the year zero, that had to go. They invented their own calendar with the revolution, the date of the revolution as the starting date for the new time era. But it was more than that. It was the active closing of churches, the suppression of clergy, the elimination of any kind of religion in the public square. That's what really, in a sense, started what might be called the broad modern culture war. And in some respects, we're still struggling with that same conflict to our time.
What is Christian democracy, at least in its bare-bones definition, and what role has that movement, that long movement, played in the culture war?
Well, its earliest glimmerings came from some fine French thinkers who reacted to the French Revolution and said it was wrong. One great one being De Bonald, who wrote a fine book called On Divorce, which criticized the French Revolution's innovations on marriage and divorce law. It really started to pick up steam, though, some 40 or 50, 60 years later. Among Protestants, one of the great early leaders was Abraham Kuyper, a Dutch pastor. He was also a Calvinist, a very strict Calvinist. He also was a politician and eventually became the prime minister of the Netherlands. And he organized something called the Anti-Revolutionary Party, which was a avowedly Christian party. It was not a conservative party. That is, it wasn't there to defend large property or the remnants of feudalism. It also wasn't a communist or a socialist party out there to seize property and turn it over to the state. It carved out something in the middle. both it exemplified, first of all, a quest for justice, that that Christians in politics should not be contentious with the way things are, but they needed to make a more just society. It also defended, if it had a thing, it defended the family. It defended small communities and neighborhoods. And the degree to which the state had to do something, say provide services or benefits, it always tried to find ways to funnel those through small communities and families to protect these vital natural institutions. The Catholic version of Christian democracy was Bishop von Ketteler of Mainz, Germany, was an early advocate for similar ideas, but it was Rerum Novarum, the great encyclical by Leo XIII in 1891, who laid out a similar case for a Christian-engaged political economy, much like that Kuyper laid out in the Netherlands.
Is there anything in American history approaching a parallel or a cousin to European Christian democracy?
In some ways, no. The American revolutionaries, while they, and since the American Revolution, the Founding Fathers was much different than the French Revolution, the early founders tended to look on the parts of the French Revolution that were similar. The rejection of feudalism, for example, the overthrow of royal tyranny. So in the United States, relatively few people have ever had the sense of the French Revolution as being anti-Christian and anti-tradition, anti-family, although it was in many respects. The reform impulses have at different times, for example, animated the Democratic Party, probably between about 1890 and 1950, 1960. When that party was the party of Southern evangelicals and Northern Catholics, for example, but it never had an explicit Christian orientation. It was always a part of a much larger coalition.
Did we get tastes of it, say, in the abolitionist movement or the civil rights movement?
Well, in a way, yes, but not exactly mediated through a political party. It is true. You're right. The abolitionist movement was was one of the outgrowths of what we sometimes call the Second Great Awakening, a great period of religious revivalism that started around 1800. Lots of new little denominations founded, preaching, spirit-filled camp meetings out on the Western frontier, all over the place. American church attendance rose dramatically. It was not only anti-slavery that came along, but also the prohibition movement came along. And perhaps if there was one party that something came close to Christian democracy, it was a very narrow party called the Prohibition Party, which eventually won the abolition of alcohol for a while. But that wouldn't be my best example. But it never had quite the same thrust. Although I did get, interestingly enough, I just received a letter that a Christian Democratic Union of the United States is now taking form as a political party. Now, whether it will go anywhere or simply die like thousands of other third-party movements remains to be seen. But there are some attempting to organize such a thing right now.
You outlined some of the differences, some of the peculiarities of a Catholic Democratic movement as opposed to a Protestant Democratic movement. What are those?
Well, they probably seemed more real to the people of the late 19th and early 20th century than they really were. The differences were mainly ones of nuances, ones of emphasis. I think on fundamental issues, the differences were not that strong. That is, both groups affirmed the kingship of Christ, both affirmed that religious communities needed to be engaged in the public square, and religious people as Christians. They had nothing to hide. There was no, applying Christian principles to politics was as natural and inevitable and necessary as applying Christian principles to any other aspect of life. They all agreed that the family was the fundamental social unit, that the role of the state was to protect such primal institutions, not to damage them or replace them. They all agreed that religious schools should be allowed not only to operate, but should enjoy an equality with so-called state or secular schools in terms of support given to them. So while there were differences of history and there were a lot of suspicions still between what we called the Catholic version and the Protestant version, I think as I look back on it, it's hard to see fundamental differences. The Protestant version, again, found affirmation not only among the work of Kuyper, the Calvinist side, but also among confessional Lutheran churches in Germany and in the Scandinavian countries, where, again, early on you saw similar understandings of Christianity and politics.
We're talking with Alan Carlson, president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois, author of several books, including his latest, Fractured Generations, Crafting a Family Policy for 21st Century America. And he's also written an article in the latest issue of Touchstone Magazine titled The Long Culture War. We're talking about the culture war and the Christian Democratic Movement. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio as we come to you live this Monday, the 20th of November, issues ETC at KFUO.org. Talk a bit about the Christian Democratic Movement in Europe post-war, first among those nations where communism did not hold sway, and then a little farther out than from post-war, post-communism, the European nations where communism had ruled for a generation.
Well, it is interesting because World War II brought an underground resurgence in Christian democratic thinking. There were a wonderful set of thinkers in France, in particular, in Italy and in Germany, anti-fascist, anti-Nazi Christians who were determined to recover and rebuild the Christian foundations of Western Europe. And Christian democracy became their vehicle. Wonderful underground articles, even Christian democratic martyrs. There was one fellow by the name of Antonin Dru, D-R-U, who wrote some wonderful pieces arguing for the restoration of Christian democracy in France after the war. He was captured by the German Gestapo and executed in 1944. I'm sorry, it was Gilbert Dru. And many others like that. Again, when the war ended, it was the Christian Democrats who put Europe back together again. The Christian Democrats were formed in France called the Movement, Popular Republican Movement. They were Christian Democrats, though. Their goal was, again, a Christian-infused public life. They came to power in France in coalition in 1946. A couple of years later, key elections, both in West Germany and Italy, these defeated countries, the first free elections. In both countries, Christian Democratic parties won power. And they did, for about 15 years, they did a lot of wonderful things. They laid the foundations for the restoration of economic growth and of prosperity. They also did it in such a way, though, that would protect the family. For example, these nations all gave preference to traditional households, male breadwinner, a female homemaker, and mother families. Their welfare systems built on that same principle. So again, it was protecting the family, at the same time creating the economic conditions that allowed great rapid growth and rebuilding these nations to occur. They laid the foundations of the European Union. Today it's a terribly secular, anti-religious community, but at its beginning, in the early initiatives, were all pursued by Christian democratic leaders trying to restore, again, something like a modern version of the Holy Roman Empire. Also bridging differences between Protestant and Catholic, consciously building unitary Christian democratic parties that unified the Christian community. So that was on the one side, and like I say, with a lot of energy and authentic enthusiasm, religious enthusiasm, into the early 1960s. Then those movements kind of petered out. The parties became kind of self-satisfied. The Christian enthusiasm kind of tended to dissipate. The parties were taken over by simply ambitious political figures who cared relatively little about the Christian rebuilding of a civilization, cared more about gaining power and holding on to it. Christian democracy, though, has had a new rebirth, as you mentioned, in Eastern Europe since 1990. Christian democratic parties have emerged in Poland, Romania, and in fact have created and have led governments. Right now in Protestant Latvia, there's a Christian democratic government that's in power that's been doing some very creative things in terms of affirming and supporting the family. The current government in Poland is animated by Christian democratic principles. These are, again, examples of a new renewal of a movement that has done, I think, some wonderful things in Europe at different times and in different places.
I find the European Union, that experiment, fascinating, especially as it relates to the American experiment, even though they would probably balk at the idea that they're building on an American model, really. But I take it from your comments just a minute ago that the European Union is really no friend to the continuance of Christian democracy today.
Unfortunately not. There is a union of Christian democratic parliamentarians at the European Union, but they're a distinct minority. And in general, the European Union has become quite hostile. You may recall a year and a half ago when a new constitution for the European Union was being considered, its drafters had consciously excluded any reference to the Christian heritage of Western Europe. They consciously excluded any reference to divine authority in what they were doing. They consciously excluded God from the document and embraced a whole series of socially radical innovations, from same-sex marriage to abortion as a right and so on. So, no, the founders of the European Union were good people with a wonderful vision. I'm afraid the heirs right now, the ones at least who dominate the EU, are no friends of the family and no friends of faith.
Then, finally, what are the lessons to be learned? Someone's listened to this and they've observed the Christian democratic movement in Europe. It's coming and it's going. It's waxing, it's waning. What are the lessons for Christian democracy in general, or the possibility of such a movement in the United States? Some people, having listened to this conversation, says maybe that's exactly what we need, as opposed to what seems to be our entrenched two-party system.
Well, I think that is. There may be some ways in which we can learn and do something better. The Republican Party has proven to be a frail vehicle for pro-family and pro-faith initiatives. First of all, I think recognize that this movement has had its most success, greatest success, when it's really adhered to the full gospel, including Christ's command that we love our neighbors as ourselves. So social justice has always been part of authentic Christian democracy. And that'll take us some places where recent conservative movement has been a little more reluctant to go. Second, this movement has successfully shown how to use necessary government programs, or even some that aren't so necessary, but to at least tie them into religious and voluntary organizations so that it's not a state program that's coming your way, but something that's been mediated through vital and organic institutions. A third lesson is that I think that Christian democracy has always seen the need to put family first and foremost in the formation of public policy. Never forget that the state is there to serve the natural family. It's not the other way around. And another lesson, I think, is that a movement like this succeeds only to the degree that it's an expression of authentic faith. It's when it becomes politicized, when the enthusiasm, when almost the sense of a revolution in favor of Christian principles, when that's lost, the movement dissipates and it becomes just another political party.
Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois. Their website address is profam.org, P-R-O-F-A-M HowardCenter.org. You'll find the Howard Center there. And Alan Carlson, he's author of several books, including his latest, Fractured Generations, Crafting Family Policy for 21st Century America. And he's also written an article on the latest Touchstone magazine, A Great History of the Culture War and of Christian Democracy in Europe. If you're looking for something that'll just get you there in a short amount of time, it's called The Long Culture War. Alan, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
Well, for the remainder of this segment and into the next, Uwe Simonetto joins us here in Studio A. We're going to talk about two-kingdom theology. It's a nice connection from our conversation with Carlson just a moment ago. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. He joins us to talk about two-kingdom theology. Uwe, welcome back.
Good evening.
You're looking very dapper this evening.
Well, I'm going out into the left-hand kingdom this evening, you see. So
going out dressed dressed for the occasion.
Dapperly for the left-hand kingdom, yes.
Tell us what you came in here excited about, what the Bishop of Saxony had done, and he actually wants to advocate dealing with Muslims in that German state through a right understanding of the two-kingdom theology. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, this is actually quite fascinating. Picking up, by the way, on what Alan Carlson said just now, because it addresses the situation in Europe, and it addresses also the need for a Christian perspective on Europe, and especially with its current what I would call Islamic manners. If you went back in Germany, in German Protestantism, you would find that it had been taken over by union theology, which is, of course, one of the reasons why the Missourian Synod exists in this country, and the Wisconsin Synod, which denies the existence or waters down the existence of two distinctive ways by which God rules this world, which is really what the Two Kingdoms Doctrine is all about. Luther never used the word Two Kingdoms Doctrine. It's modern shorthand for it, but very good shorthand, so I'm all in favor of it. Bishop Pohl of the state-related or territorial church of Saxony, that is really the home church of Martin Luther, in a sense, who actually comes out of a union background, but then, of course, one has to admit that even in union churches, you have a majority of Lutheran constituted or congregations, so I would not deny his Lutheranism. Bishop Pohl now announced to his synod, his church parliament meeting in Dresden, that it is time to return to the Two Kingdoms doctrine, which had been washed away to the extent that even in a Saxon hymnal, they had snipped off the last the last six articles of the Augsburg Confession, including, of course, Article 28, which describes the Two Kingdoms doctrine, which is all under the influence of union theology, of Reformed theology.
Let's take a break right here. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, I want you to finish this story about the bishop there in Saxony advocating the return to a solid, full-bodied two-kingdom theology to deal with what Uwe Simonetto has already called here in our beginning of our conversation, the Islamic menace. We'll talk about two-kingdom theology. Will it work beyond something like Saxony? And what are the other benefits of understanding God's two ways of ruling in this world?
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. Carl Fakencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on good reasons to become a pastor.
Before I went to the seminary, I worked in business for a number of years, and I enjoyed very much what I was doing, but I realized that the aspects of my jobs that I appreciated the most certainly were the opportunities to be helpful and encouraging and supportive of the people who worked with me. And it was quite clear to me, without any question, that the way I could be most helpful to them was sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, their Savior. And I realized that if I became a pastor, that would be what I'd do all the time, and I would never be restricted in any way in what I could say. The help that I could bring to people that I cared about would be the help that was not just for today or tomorrow, but eternal.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. National headlines herald that 60% of Americans want some form of recognition for gay couples. The Opinion Dynamics Fox News poll breaks it down further. 30% favor gay marriage, and another 30% back civil unions. But in the only gauge that really matters, Americans overwhelmingly show they do not support alternatives to traditional marriage. Steve Jordahl reports.
Jim Paff of Colorado Family Action needs to make an appointment with a garage door repairman.
I mean, I can't open it with automatic. I have to do it manually.
He ran into it with his car while he was rushing to shut the door on gay marriage in Colorado. He has a problem with the way the poll was reported.
It says here that 30% of people want to allow same-sex couples to get legally married, but it doesn't talk about 70% don't.
Colorado was one of seven states that passed marriage amendments in the election. Glenn Stanton, a Focus on the Family.
But when people vote with their feet and go out and support these things, I mean, that's a very, very strong statement. So, you know, polls come and polls go.
Peter LaBarbera of Americans for Truth says most Americans are more comfortable expressing their true beliefs in the voting booth than to a pollster on the phone.
The problem is a lot of people have drank the Kool-Aid, thinking that if they criticize homosexuality, then they're some kind of intolerant person or a bigot or a homophobe. Whether it's politically acceptable, politically correct or not, it really shouldn't affect our position.
For LaBarbera, homosexuality is wrong no matter what any survey finds. And based on recent elections, many agree with him. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
27 states have constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. 17 others have some form of protection, such as a Defense of Marriage Act, on the record. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Give someone a bear hug this holiday. With every grizzly bear adoption in the St. Louis Zoo Parents Program, each proud parent will receive a cuddly plush toy grizzly bear while supplies last. This gift will help provide food and care for Bert and Ernie, the zoo's grizzlies. Adoptions and memberships may be ordered by phone. Call the St. Louis Zoo. St. Louis Zoo adoptions and memberships make great holiday gifts.
You can read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, titled The Great Jesus Debates, on our website, issuesetc.org. It's a book about the battle in the early church over the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Great Jesus Debates is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Great Jesus Debates costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. That title again, The Great Jesus Debates.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here halfway through the program, we're continuing our conversation. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest here in Studio A, and we're talking about two-kingdom theology. Coming up in about 25 minutes, Bishop N.T. Wright, Bishop of Durham in England, is going to join us. He is of great scholarly note, but he's also author of numerous books. His latest is called Evil and the Justice of God. We'll talk about the problem of evil with Bishop N.T. Wright coming up in about 25 minutes here on Issues Etc. We are coming to you live this Monday, the 20th of November. Happy to take your phone calls and your emails as we talk about two-kingdom theology with Uwe Simonetto. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. When we had to go to that break, Uwe, you were in the middle of telling us about the Bishop of Saxony in Germany just today calling for a resurgence of this two-kingdom theology to deal with the Islamic menace. Pick up where you left off.
Yes. Well, what he said is, you know, only if we make the proper distinctions between the two kingdoms can we argue theologically with this growing, he wouldn't call it a menace, but a growing influx of Muslims into Germany. Not so much actually into Saxony, because Saxony is in the east, but it is a national issue. And how do you dialogue with them? How can you even converse with them unless you come from a proper position that distinguishes between law and gospel, and that allows you, that gives you the freedom to dirty your hands in the left-hand kingdom here in the secular world? And that is what Bishop Bowl whose state-related church, the Church of Saxony, is probably the most orthodox of the state religious churches in Germany.
What challenge does he face if he's successful in doing this, given the fact that, as far as we can tell, and we've talked about this before in conversations on Islam, Islam as a religion and as a political philosophy fails to distinguish between two kingdoms and fails to distinguish between mosque and state. That's a huge challenge.
Well, he faces, I'll tell you where he faces when he, within the Protestant state-related churches in Germany, he faces flak from actually a dying breed. One has to be fair about that. These are the offspring, the spiritual offspring of the 1960s theologians that crippled Protestantism in Germany, that brought a 19th century Protestant liberalism to its most absurd conclusion. And they are still there. They are still wafting through the parishes and church offices. But a new breed of journalists trained by much more orthodox Lutherans is now slowly moving in. And so Bishop Bowell will certainly have the support of the younger clergy in Germany, who clearly see what problems not just the Germans but others face in Europe with Islam, but also with other other forms of religion that that cannot distinguish between church and state and faith and reason, to wit, the kerfuffle over the Pope's reminder to his fellow Germans and Europeans to distinguish properly between faith and reason. Of course, the solids flew. So in that sense, I am actually heartened by it, especially since this corresponds with similar trends. They are not, it's not a wave. We're not talking about a sort of huge movement yet. And thank God it isn't, because then I would be very distrustful of it. But there is a similar, there are similar trends in France, where suddenly theologians, I've talked to one of them this morning extensively, a French theologian by the name of Cuvier down in Montpellier, who is the one who has reintroduced law and gospel and the two kingdoms to French theology, which of course until now had been totally reformed theology, to the extent that they thought that with the victory of Viet Cong in Vietnam and, of course, the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, we had the second coming. I mean, that is, you had these unmitigated morons in the church. And suddenly they awakened and said, well, wait a minute, no, this cannot be right. And then what does Luther have to offer? And, well, we hear this more and more. What does Luther have to offer? You heard Mark Knoll the other day. You had him here on radio. You had Bob Benny. It is, more and more of these people are saying it is time to return to Luther for precisely this reason.
What other benefits does this insight, the two-kingdom theology, that God rules simultaneously over all men in two realms, one the civil realm through reason and force, and the other the church through the word and the sacraments toward the end of the forgiveness of sins. What other benefits does this insight have for people living everyday lives here in America?
The benefit is that we can cheerfully dirty our hands, that we can go about our daily work, that we can relax. I think the other day I used this wonderful German word which comes out of Lutheranism. It's called Gelassenheit. Be relaxed. Get on with your work. Do what you have to do. Don't keep stopping every 5 seconds thinking, well, maybe I could have wronged somebody or violated God's command. Yes, we are sinners. We do that all the time. But in the meantime, the world has to run. This is why God sent Christ. I mean, this is that's what we have the right-hand kingdom for. It is this marvelous Lutheran distinction which is not, we shouldn't say we are better. It's simply something that grows in our garden and that we should let other people taste as well in their gardens, mm-hmm. you know. And that is this wonderful distinction between the kingdom to the left, where we live, where we have no choice but dirtying our hands, where we have duties and obligations vis-a-vis our fellow man, where you have to make the traffic run on the right-hand side of the road, where you have to make sure that people aren't drunk when they're driving, where that's where you have to ensure that trains hopefully run on time, not in the United States, but in other parts of the world, where you have all these things and where you then always can go back to the altar, to the cross, where we are, under which we're living anyway, and rejoice in the forgiveness in Christ. Nobody has ever said this clearly, and I don't understand why Lutherans of all people, you know, I travel around this country, I lecture on the two kingdoms and, of course, the very related doctrine of vocation, and I find that even Lutheran pastors have not really got a proper idea, often, not many do, of course, but that many pastors don't actually know what this really means, what the implications of the two kingdoms doctrine are, how liberating this doctrine is. And, of course, they do not, because they don't know it themselves, they are not teaching their congregants that. And this is why we are a minority operation in here in the United States, even though we should be a rather sizable chunk given the educational standards in, among Lutherans here. We should be a sizable chunk. We're not, because we are quietists, which is precisely what others accuse us of being due to the two kingdoms of doctrine, but of course it is a violation of the two kingdoms of doctrine of being quietist. We should get involved.
See, some people hear this distinction, and what they hear is, it's a failure to understand, as you've just pointed out, what the scriptural insight really is. They'll say, well, if there's the right-hand kingdom, left-hand kingdom, it really presents me a choice of which one I want to live in. So I feel more secure living in the right-hand kingdom. I will retreat to the safe confines of my church work or my sacred duties and not dirty my hands out there in the world.
Well, this is precisely it. But then there's the other part, which is even more troubling, and that is that they say, well, you know, two kingdoms doctrine is dualistic. We are in the right-hand kingdom, so we're saved, so therefore we can cheerfully go out Monday mornings after singing Amazing Grace in church and murder our children. Mm-hmm. You know, 45 million dead babies are something not to be sneezed at. I mean, this is something that really should trouble conscience. And then you can say, well, you know, the left-hand kingdom, it's legal. It's legal. You can do this. You can actually, right until the moment of birth, you can legally slaughter your child. Suck the brains out of this poor little kid's head and then until the head collapses and yank it out of the birth canal. And you can do all these things and feel very good about yourself, or you can't. And the reason is, for a Lutheran who does this, he doesn't understand the two kingdoms doctrine, because the left-hand kingdom has the law. Left-hand kingdom has the law. The left-hand kingdom has, first of all, the Mosaic law and natural law, which is also why same-sex marriage, of course, is absurd in the left-hand kingdom. And if you say, well, yeah, but the law says you can, this is neither natural law, because your instinct, your conscience must tell you that it's wrong. The only thing that you have is positive law, which is the law that humans cook up to justify themselves. And then, of course, you're really in deep doo-doo, you see, because you're dealing with positive law. You're saying positive law is equals natural law, equals divine law, which God has written on everybody's heart. And that, of course, is a huge lie, and that is diabolical.
So you had mentioned partial birth abortion in a sidelong way just a moment ago, and someone's going to say, look, this is what we should do on that issue. Those lawyers arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court to ban partial birth abortion, you know, they've just made their arguments.
Yeah.
They should have gone in there with their Bibles. They should have gone in there and quoted chapter and verse to those justices and said, this is against God's clear word in Holy Scripture, and that should have settled the matter in that courtroom. How would you respond to that?
I would say no, they shouldn't. I would say you should go and say, search your consciences. There is nothing in the Bible that says thou shalt not kill every Jew in the country. I mean, you know, it's a given that you shouldn't, but the Nazis did it anyway. I mean, anybody they could find. We have a conscience. We have this is what we call natural law. It's what St. Paul says. It's written upon our hearts. If you could show images of aborted foeti to the judges, I suppose they would not accept this. But you can't. The population doesn't see this. You don't have this on television, unless you go into some very spooky websites where you can find it. But then you find it with all sorts of other very unpleasant things. So it is not that. It is simply search your heart. You know this. You are living in the left-hand kingdom, not in a void, without guidance from God.
I heard one of the arguments made in favor of that ban on partial birth abortion. And the lawyer, it was made outside the courtroom, but I think probably also in essence made inside. Person said, listen. And it was an argument that struck me as entirely from our commonly held reason.
Right.
He said, it would be more healthy for the mother to bring the child to term, have the child be born, and then have the doctor simply throttle the child 20 feet away from the mother. Then the mother's completely safe. If you worry about the safety of the mother and you don't want to ban this procedure because it's unsafe for the mother to not allow her to do this. Sounds to me like an argument that appeals to everyone's reason in the matter rather than opening the Bible and quoting chapter and verse.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's precisely what I'm talking about. You cannot argue with the Bible in front of people who have no idea what the Bible is, who don't believe in the Bible. But the fascinating aspect of natural law is that the Aborigines in Australia had natural law before the first missionary ever set foot there. The same thing applies to any other tribe. There are certain things that we understand instinctively or rightly, or instinctively is, I think, the wrong expression because we're not dogs, but we understand that are right and that are wrong. It's wrong to commit adultery. It's wrong to murder. It's wrong to kill your children. You don't have to be Christian for that. And this is precisely what Luther said. Luther said, very interestingly, he'd rather have a wise Turk than a foolish Christian sit on a throne. Why would he say that? Well, he would know that the wise Turk has wisdom, and wisdom is given to him by God. And a foolish Christian may not have wisdom, and might be, you know, we know plenty of those about. So I think this is such a healthy doctrine that we should actually push and broaden, should teach in every congregation around the clock.
As to Luther's wise Turk, foolish Christian quote, when you come in next time, can you track that down for us? We have been looking for the reference of that because it is often quoted. But the contrast that Luther is making there, if I hear you correctly, is not between Turk and Christian, but between wise and foolish.
That's right.
Because what it takes to sit on the throne is wisdom, not necessarily a religious viewpoint.
Yeah. I think it is in one of the exegeses of his, one of Luther's expositions of Psalms, 82 or 101 or 110, one of those. But it is precisely, that wisdom. You know, Luther used this term, for example, the German word Wundermann or via miraculosus. It's a man created miraculously to certain functions. It's our doctrine of predestination, which differs greatly from the Reformed doctrine of predestination, that God predestines certain people to perform certain functions, like leading a nation, he used Frederick the Wise of Saxony, mm-hmm. Making the Reformation possible. You don't have to be an ardent Christian. You don't have to be a Lutheran to be that. I mean, I've in my life, I've run into so many people, there are so many friends who are not Christians, and they have infinitely more wisdom than many of my Christian friends.
The Old Testament example is Cyrus.
Cyrus. Well, Luther used Cyrus, actually, mm-hmm. as an example. And I, you know, I simply, I'm so concerned with this, Todd, that Dale Meyer, the president of the seminary, and I have decided to launch a podcast program on SemNet, explaining the Two Kingdoms doctrine, explaining it as in the same sense that we've been trying to explain the doctrine of vocation as a way to defeat the me syndrome. If you are a member, if you see yourself as a citizen of two kingdoms, especially as a citizen of the left-hand kingdom, the world, then you are not a me man. You cannot be, because everything is interconnected. And I believe that we in the Lutheran Church, especially in the Missouri Synod, but the other Lutheran churches as well, if they are faithful Lutherans, have no more important obligation right now in this desperate situation where we are really at the threshold of World War III, if we're not already involved in World War III, where we are facing a nuclear power threatening us, namely Iran. We have no more important obligation than to inform our congregants that as Christians, we are called to dirty our hands. We are called to get involved in the left-hand kingdom. We are called to get involved in politics and journalism and economics and everything else, always, of course, bearing in mind that there is the right-hand kingdom of which we're also citizens, where we can find solace and, of course, salvation.
Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking about two-kingdom theology with Dr. Uwe Simonetto. He's an international journalist and director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. He just mentioned a few minutes ago his book, Fabricated Luther. It's coming out in the second and expanded edition pretty soon. Herman calls from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Dr. Simonetto, he mentioned the Bishop of Saxony and Dr. Robert Binney here in the United States. Dr. Binney, I know, is in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and he is somewhat on the sidelines if you really want to compare where he stands against the so-called current defined mainstream leadership of the ELCA. Dr. Simonetto, do you think that the renewed Lutheran focus coming from the Bishop of Saxony, and can the voices like Dr. Binney be marshaled to prevail against the influence, especially in the Lutheran World Federation, that the present kind of demeanor of the ELCA represents in that vein?
All right. Thank you very much, Herman.
Excellent question, Herman. Thank you very much for asking this. Well, let's start with my friend Robert Binney, whom I've known for many years. Binney is, of course, not a bishop. He's not even a pastor. He is a lay theologian. In that sense, he is like me. And Binney is an ardent and wonderful writer. And I believe he will ultimately prevail, because we know this much about heresies. You know, you have to, Lutherans especially should know that God, God's care of the world doesn't span just months and years, but actually spans centuries and millennia. The heresies, the nonsense that you find in the ELCA and elsewhere right now, that will not prevail. That's not going to last forever. That's going to fall off like a dead foot. Whereas writers of the quality of Robert Binney, and there are many others in the ELCA, will prevail because they have the spirit. Now, that is a faith statement, but I think it's also an objective statement. The other thing is, when you talk to about Bishop Bowell, there is a tectonic shift underway in Europe at the moment, especially in Germany, where suddenly people wake up to the fact that they have been drifting away from essentials. And, of course, it took the alarm clock of Islamic invasion of Europe to shake them loose a little bit. So I believe I would not despair. I quite to the contrary, I'm quite hopeful.
Our time is short as our time winds down. Mark is calling from his car. A brief question or comment from Mark and a brief response from Uwe. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. I was wondering if Mr. Simonetto thinks that Orthodoxy will revive one retirement at a time. In other words, the old liberal guard retires, and then as the younger people take over, Orthodoxy will revise.
Thank you very much. It's a great question. I called it a revolution of attrition. What do you think, Uwe?
Well, look, I think he's so good, this guy. I think why don't we just let it stand? Orthodoxy awakes one retirement at a time. I mean, you should have that copyrighted. You know, that's just very good stuff.
I'll just leave that to Mark to copyright his own comment there. Finally, one more example with only 1 minute to respond. Race relations continues to be a huge issue in the United States and elsewhere, not dealing with the issue so much of Islam in the United States, but of the ongoing race relations conflict. Yeah. You have written that the Two Kingdom Theology is an insight uniquely suited to dealing with the race problem in the United States. You got 1 minute to put it in a nutshell for us.
In a nutshell, if you can be bothered to sit with a member of a different race in the same church Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, if you pray together, sing together, for God's sake, drink coffee afterwards together or sherry like the Episcopalians, then surely what is left-hand kingdoms at stake, take for example affirmative action, can be more easily resolved by reason, because you're not dealing with an enemy, you're dealing with somebody you know as your brother, and you're not dealing with an enemy. So therefore, race relations, the parts of race relations that are matters for a practical reason to resolve, like, for example, affirmative action. Does it make sense? Does it make no sense? How does it make sense? How can we resolve it? What alternatives can we come up with? Would be infinitely easier. But if people of similar faith sit and do not sit together, do not pray together, are not part of, see not themselves in the right-hand kingdom together, they'll never make it in the left-hand kingdom together.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is an international journalist. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. I mentioned just a moment ago his great book, Fabricated Luther, is going to be coming out soon again in a second edition, an expanded edition. When do you expect to see that come out again?
In early summer, I hope.
All right. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Bishop N.T. Wright, Bishop of Durham in England. He's got a new book called Evil and the Justice of God. Well, it's the perpetual problem of evil. He says that the usual responses, especially those philosophical responses to the problem of evil, have not really cut the Gordian knot, or at least what appears to be that Gordian knot of evil in the world. Can we understand why evil exists? Why a good God would permit evil to exist in his creation? We'll answer some of those questions on the other side of this break. And then in the last 10 minutes of the program, we've got audio open lines for your questions or your comments. We've got so much to get through that we didn't get to before. I really have no idea what we'll bring to you in the last 10 minutes. We've got tons of stuff. Perhaps it'll be an NPR report on the arguments heard in the Missouri Supreme Court on parental notification. Oh, I know what I want to get to. The allegedly deceptive tactics used by crisis pregnancy centers from ABC News. That'll come up in the last 10 minutes of Issues, etc.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, etc.